Paul, I'm going to be giving a talk on Jewish environmental ethics in terms of, from a Jewish perspective, what our obligations are to the natural world and our relationship to the natural world, and it might be of interest to people in the class. So if you are interested, again, at 7 p.m. in the Founders Room of Annabelle Taylor Hall this Thursday night.
Michal, could you announce that again on Thursday? Would you remember to do that? Because I would very much like to urge you to attend that, as many as you can, because Michal is doing some of the really pioneering work in the country today on developing an environmental education outreach program for Jews, and it's going to be very, very important work. And I think it would be helpful to her to get your feedback, your reactions, and so on. I don't want to make it an assignment because it's not in the regular class time, but I would very strongly urge you to attend that. I think it will be interesting in itself and is very closely related to the course. One of the frustrations of the course is that we can't have a second semester that focuses more intensely on Jewish ethics and also some material, say, from Native American and Buddhist sources and so on. And this would be just a little bit of a stopgap to give you just a little bit of a feeling for the kinds of things she's working on. Thank you, Michal, and please announce that on Thursday again. Good. The topic this morning is an interesting one. Do women have unique contributions to make to environmental ethics? It's a touchy topic, as you know, one that I approach with some trepidation because it crosses over into that strange and mysterious area of politically correct and incorrect thinking, and I have a feeling that it's a topic that a lot of faculty would just as soon not touch on. I've had a long-standing interest in this topic. I did my doctoral thesis at Harvard on the use of male-female categories in ancient literature, classical literature, particularly religious literature, for structuring reality and understanding the world we live in. I had originally wanted to focus on St. Paul's comment in Galatians 3:28 that in Christ there is neither Jew nor Gentile, slave nor free, male nor female. And then as part of the background for this, worked on the Jewish Hellenistic philosopher Philo of Alexandria, and that became so totally, utterly engrossing and fascinating that I ended up doing the entire thesis on Philo and just had a few appendices on Paul and later published a book focusing specifically on Philo. It's been an issue of very great interest to me over the years, and particularly because of the way we have seen the resurgence of feminism and all the benefits and questions and so on that this has brought to us. It is a tough issue to talk about in the modern university, I think for a number of reasons. In the first place, the view that men and women are essentially clones of each other, except you might say for obvious differences in plumbing, although it's not widespread among the general public, has a fairly strong place still in the university. Not as strong as 20 or 30 years ago, where this was almost dogma at that time. An increasing number of women are questioning that view, but it still holds sway among some, and in some cases is difficult to discuss. I ought to add a caveat right at the beginning that I'm not in any of the lecture today talking about individuals. It's obvious, to me at least, that many men are more like most women, and or at least some men and some women are more like most men. We're not talking about individuals. I'm talking about sets with overlapping characteristics. It's my view that we all have a feminine side and a masculine side, and it's just that the mix is different in different people. I've always been fascinated and with the fact, and maybe this is one reason why the topic's been of so much interest to me, that when I've done these various psychological tests, I always come out right in the middle between male and female. In spite of the fact that I'm fairly aggressive in my thinking and lecturing, there seems to be a very strong nurturing side, and thus it's not surprising that when my kids were little, I took a major part in diapering and bathing and feeding them. I was the one who used to get up at night and loved it. I didn't see it in any way as a burden. I thought it was an extraordinary privilege to be able to do that. And even now that my wife is severely handicapped, her nurture is something that I thoroughly enjoy. It's burdensome at times simply because of time conflicts, but in itself it's something that I find very challenging and fulfilling. So, not talking about individuals, talking here about sets that are in many, many ways overlapping. I think in the second place, differences real or alleged between men and women, male and female, have been used in very powerful and insidious ways through the centuries to discriminate against women. I think this is one of the most obvious facts and one of the greatest benefits that's come out of the last 30 years or so, and that we realize how invidious some of this discrimination was. If I had time, I could take examples from my book on Philo of Alexandria that clearly show that in Philo's view, and here he was not thinking, incidentally, as a typical Jew. He was really thinking as a Jew that had been very, very strongly influenced by Hellenistic, Greek, Gnostic-type thinking, because these ideas are really foreign to historic Judaism. But Philo saw the female as that part of the self that had to be overcome, and that salvation, one of the ways he used to describe it, was in terms of the phrase becoming male, that both the male and the female had to, in a spiritual, psychological sense, become male. And, of course, he then associated the male with the higher brain functions, intellect, and so on, and the female with sexuality and the emotions and feelings and so on. And you can obviously see that that could have a pretty pernicious impact on how we viewed actual men and women, just full of horror stories. In fact, my book has been fairly widely used in some radical feminist courses as a source of horror stories, because I document them fairly well, this tremendous negativity towards the female and towards women. I think you can see this in more modern times in someone like Francis Bacon. If you take his writing, The New Atlantis, published posthumously in 1627, where he viewed scientific knowledge largely in terms of power and as offering the possibility of human control over the natural environment. If we look closely at some of his language, I find it rather frightening at times. He speaks of, quote, shaping nature on an anvil. He refers to the victory of art over nature in the contest between the two. He refers to setting traps for nature in the form of experiments. He typically refers to nature with the feminine pronoun. Example, for you have but to follow, I'm quoting, and as it were, hound nature in her wanderings, and you will be able, when you like, to lead and drive her afterwards to the same place again. I'm drawing these examples from William Lice's splendid book, The Domination of Nature. I say splendid. Lice writes as a neo-Marxist. I think his analysis is just powerful. I'm not sure I fully agree. In fact, I'm quite sure I don't fully agree with all of his policy recommendations, but the analysis is strong. And Lice summarizes Bacon's philosophy in the words, and I quote, human art and knowledge are the weapons with which men compel nature, mind you, nature now is feminine, compel nature to do their bidding. Lice concludes that, quote, the vital legacy of magic and alchemy is revealed in Bacon's terminology, which displays strong overtones of aggression, including the sexual aggression connected with the feminine gender of the noun, that is the noun nature, and the use of her as the pronoun, hounding, vexing, subduing. These are just a few of many examples that could be given. I think that one of the great achievements of the past 30 years or so is that we've become very aware of how much terminology of that sort colors our thinking and how detrimental it has been to women over the centuries and in some ways still in our own day. I have a third item here that I think is also related to why this topic is difficult to talk about, and this comment will probably be somewhat more controversial, if not somewhat explosive. It's my non-scientific sort of seat-of-the-pants observation. I think there is many women today harbor a great deal of latent anger against men, and it's my conviction that a very large part of it is justified, and that this latent anger tends to color some of the discussion of this kind of issue. It's my judgment that the anger is related to the substantial failure of the sexual revolution. I think we're going to, in 20, 30, 40 years, look back on the past 30 years as a time of extremism where we have turned so far away from traditional views of marriage and sexual fidelity that we wonder how we ever got there. And I think what is happening is that many men and women are being badly used by each other sexually today, and that probably overall this takes a much heavier toll on women than on men. And I think this anger, in part simply because women pay a much higher price in sexually transmitted diseases and the possibility of pregnancy and all the rest. And I think this anger, which in my judgment is largely justified, clouds our thinking in some cases on these kinds of issues. I think it just makes it extremely difficult to approach some of these issues in a rational way. I just before I left on a trip this past weekend was reading a book review in First Things by a professor, Jean Bethke Eilstein. She's at Vanderbilt University, and she was reviewing Katie Roif's book, The Morning After, Sex, Fear, and Feminism on Campus, and one example sort of jumped out at me here. She was commenting, Roif was, on an experience she had at one of the large universities in Colorado. It sounds like Boulder to me, except I'm not quite sure. And she came across a poster put out by the Equal Opportunity Developmental Office listing some 20 pointers about sexual harassment and date rape. The one that caught my eye read, do not believe that if you dress provocatively, drink to excess, and go to a boy's room, you are asking for sex or to blame if sex occurs. And then Jean Eilstein says, say what? Let me see if I get this straight. I dress provocatively. I drink not a few drinks, but to excess. I go to a boy's room. Then I wake up the next morning and accuse him of rape. Is this the plot line? You bet it is. What is pernicious about this sort of business is that it constructs the young woman as a wholly irresponsible agent whose one act of agency consists in accusing the young man of an opportunistic, at best, violent, at worst, act. What she's arguing, in effect, is fascinating, that kind of thinking, which I think understandably grows out of the anger, fundamentally dehumanizes the woman. It basically puts her back 100 years into the Victorian period where she's like a child because she's no longer a responsible moral agent. She's just a victim. She's simply acted upon, and the only thing she can do is, after experiencing all of this victimization, she can file charges or complain about it. And Jean Eilstein says this is hardly progress in her view. It represents this this pushing the woman back into a kind of infantile, dependent role, and she's denied moral agency. That's just one example of, I think, how extraordinarily difficult these kinds of issues are to deal with. Obviously, she's not letting the guy off the hook in this case. She believes he was fully responsible for what he did. What she's arguing is that here, as almost all cultures have done throughout all of history, we need a kind of co-responsibility in how we approach these difficult issues. Now, we're reading some stuff this week from Plumwood and Carol Gilligan and others that basically suggest that the way most men have done ethics through the last three or four centuries has been strongly prejudiced towards the male. It has been strongly prejudicial against women. Gilligan gets some of her clues from some of the work of Piaget and others in childhood development, and one of the stories that I think is most illustrative was the observation, I think made originally by Piaget, I don't remember this exactly, that he found it interesting that when little boys are playing games with each other, all kinds of games, which is in itself a fascinating thing, because if you want to talk about a watershed change, kids don't play like we used to 40, 50 years ago. We had no television and so on, and every evening after an early dinner, you'd be out on the street with other kids playing games of all sorts, and it was an enormously good situation, I think, in terms of learning, because you weren't so passive, and typically, in some cases, boys and girls played together, in other cases, each had their own games. But Piaget, with a question mark, I'm not sure it's Piaget, I think so, comments that when little boys were playing games and would get into an argument about the rules, typically they would argue with each other, stop playing for a moment, but argue with each other till they settled the argument, usually verbally, but sometimes with a little bit more than that, settle the argument and go back to playing the game. Whereas with a very high frequency, it was found that when little girls were playing games together and got into arguments about the rules, they typically would stop playing the game altogether and go on to play something else because it seemed too threatening to fight it out with each other. Carol Gilligan's comment is that she thinks that the possibility of threatening the relationship was too great, and they just didn't want to take that chance. And from this, she draws the observation, obviously with many much more data and many more intermediate assumptions and so on, that relationships probably on the whole are more important for young girls and young boys. And she goes on then to a second example. She looks at the work of Harvard psychologist and philosopher Lawrence Kohlberg, K-O-H-L-B-E-R-G, and comments on the fact that with high regularity, when girls and young women took Kohlberg's tests of moral development with its six stages of moral advancement, girls and women typically scored one and more often two stages below boys and men. That is, suggesting that they are, as a total set, less moral. And this troubled Gilligan a great deal, as I think it should have troubled Kohlberg, but he didn't quite get the point. She found out that Kohlberg used boys and young men as all of his samples. He didn't use women. And she began to reflect on all of this and ask, now, what's going on? It seems a priori unlikely that despite all the prejudice of Plato and Philo of Alexandria and various periods of the Christian church and so on. It seems a priori unlikely to me, she said, that women should be less moral as a total set than men. What's going on? Well, this is why her work, I think, is so fascinating. She began to discover through other studies, through other work of her own, through reflection on this, that it probably is the case that taken as a total set, that men tend to think more in terms of hard and fast rules of justice, no exceptions, this is the rule, do it or else, a very, in some ways, rigid view of justice and rules and principles and so on, whereas she argued that there's very good evidence that women, as a set, were not talking about individuals, I remind you again, tended to think more in terms of relationship, in terms of caring, in terms of a kind of nurturing togetherness. They tended to think more ecologically, more holistically, more in terms of the total kinds of impacts of these various decisions. And Carol Gilligan began to realize that it wasn't just Kohlberg, but that there was a great deal in the modern Western world, in the field of ethics, that was just hugely prejudicial against women, because it tended to see as the norm, as the only desirable way of doing ethics, this kind of very strictly, tightly argued, principled rule method of doing ethics. Think of Kant and Bentham and some of the social contract theories and others. One of the reasons, and I mentioned this in an earlier class, why I so strongly resonate with this is that I have had the same experience in my professional work that many women have had. That is, theological ethics as a total set tends, although it draws on Kant and Bentham and many others in details, and Rawls and Locke and the whole bunch, and values some of those insights very highly, and at times takes a fairly principled approach and so on. Theological ethics as a set tends overall to be much closer to what Gilligan describes as the way women typically think about moral reality. That is, theological ethics tends, at least in parts of the Christian tradition, and less often, but to some degree in parts of Judaism and in other traditions, tends to think in terms of relationship, in terms of caring. A term in Judaism like shalom doesn't mean just peace in the absence of as the absence of warfare. It means a kind of wholeness, a kind of state of being blessed, a kind of flourishing that involves your relationships with your spouse, your children, your community. It's a very ecological concept, a very powerful concept. And I have had the experience that this whole range of categories, such as sin and forgiveness and alienation, estrangement, reconciliation, caring, responsibility, tends to put me outside of the mainstream of the discussion in the university when it comes to doing ethics. And that's a lousy feeling, as I commented on in an earlier class. It isn't that people are always arguing with me. That would be tolerable. It's that most often they just ignore this kind of way of thinking about ethics. Now, my sense is that this is part of the power of Gilligan and Noddings and Plumwood and others' work, is they're saying this simply is not tolerable, particularly in light of the powerful evidence that's accumulating, that empirically it looks as if men and women as sets, not as individuals, do approach ethics in different ways. Now, she's saying, incidentally, of course, that in effect there's a feminine and masculine part in each of us, so we all employ both to some degree. We're not talking about either or, except in cases that perhaps become almost pathological. We're talking about both and, but what we're talking about is the mixture, whether you tend more towards one side or the other. I find this extremely liberating in some ways, but it is a touchy issue to deal with, because when you say some of the things that this could imply, these become immediately controversial. For instance, I think empirically there's more and more solid evidence that children flourish better overall with maternal or paternal care, than they do with surrogate care. And there's also fairly powerful evidence that I think that overall it's much more likely that women will prefer to nurture children than men. The problem is that we have put a very low valuation on the nurturing role. I am quite serious when I say that I don't think anything at Cornell is as important as nurturing small children. I think the future of this society is probably considerably more dependent on the nurturing of small children than on the work that I do at Cornell. And it's even easier for me to believe that when it comes to the work of lawyers and Wall Street financiers and so on. I'm not just taking a negative view towards business. I think business is also an honorable calling, as is law, but we have excesses. Thus, when you suggest that Gilligan's thinking might imply that we relook at the whole issue of how we raise our children, that we reevaluate things like daycare and begin to question the tremendously strong bias of most government agencies and so on towards daycare as over against home care, this issue begins to be fairly explosive. Just one example, I think, of how far-reaching this is. I'm not sure if I've referred to this in an earlier lecture or not, but if you look at the number of women in the workforce who have small children, 75% plus would prefer to be home nurturing their children than working outside the home. And the major reason they're not is purely economic. And one reason that has happened is this has been our government's policy, not an overt, rationally discussed policy, but a policy that has simply evolved in a sense by benign neglect. In 1948, I think it was, the personal deduction was $600. If that had kept up with inflation, it would be worth around $8,000 today, which means if you had a husband, a wife, and three children, and ordinary home mortgage deductions and medical deductions and charitable gift deductions, you would not pay a penny of state or federal taxes till you were earning over $50,000 or so a year. It was economically far more possible for women or men to nurture children at home 50 years ago than it is today because of changes in tax policy. I use that as just one example. Now, why do I see this as important in relation to the environment? Just one comment before I address that, that will sort of structure my thinking somewhat. It appears to me that drawing on the kinds of observations that Gilligan and others have made, although I've actually thought this for many years, that the most powerful discrimination in America today and in much of the Western world against women is not that we have discriminated against them in terms of careers and education and wages and so on, a totally indefensible discrimination in my judgment, and here we've made great progress. The more powerful form of discrimination, I think, is that as a culture we have, and to an amazing extent still, value male type of values and goals more than female. And I think the tragedy of what we're doing in our universities, for instance, is that as we hire more women, in most cases we're forcing them to act just like men have traditionally acted, in a very rigorously analytical, objective, control-oriented, domination-oriented in terms of ideas, way of thinking and acting. And I don't think that does a lot of good. It's my judgment that we will truly become a freer society when we recognize that male and female are different as sets, when we recognize that each individual is different and we have to take those differences seriously, and realize that nurturing, caring, a holistic type of values and relationships are every bit as valuable as those that have traditionally been associated more closely with a male. In fact, I would argue that in our own age, they're more valuable. I think our own age suffers from the horrible danger of nuclear holocaust and control-oriented technology going berserk. And I think, if anything, the female values, as I call them in quotes, are more necessary today than the, quote, male values. And thus it's not surprising to me that women have tended to be more active in animal welfare rights, they've tended to be more active in anti-nuclear protests, they've tended to be more active in protests against toxic waste pollution and so on. Those would all fit within this model. Okay, that I needed just to throw in before a few comments that I want to draw from the work of Wendell Berry, particularly his fascinating book, The Unsettling of America. We used to use that in this course, and I may use it again once in a while. It gets tiresome just to keep using the same books, and I change them just for my own sake and the TAs. But then like to come back to some of them. In Chapter 7 of The Unsettling of America, which is entitled The Body and the Earth, Berry presents what to me seems like a very provocative and important thesis. He argues that there are some close connections and parallels between the way we treat our bodies, and particularly between the way male and female, men and women, relate to each other, and our views of human sexuality, and the way we relate to the earth. And his thesis, in short, and I'll follow this up with a few specific quotes, is that we should not be surprised that we are so exploitative of the earth as long as we remain so exploitative of our bodies in some ways. That is, that we tend in some cases just to use our bodies as if they are only vessels for the mind and soul or whatever. But more specifically, as long as we continue as men and women, male and female, to exploit each other sexually and in our marriages and in our relationships so badly. He argues that it is hard for him to see how we can treat the earth with fidelity, with faithfulness, with responsibility, if we do not know fidelity and faithfulness and caring and responsibility in our relations with one another, and particularly in the sexual relations and in marriage. He says that the root of culture must be the realization that uncontrolled energy is disorderly, that in nature all energies move in forms, that therefore in a human order energies must be given forms. He says in another passage, and I quote, "It must have been plain at the beginning, as cultural degeneracy has made it plain again and again, that one can be indiscriminately sexual, but not indiscriminately responsible, and that irresponsible sexuality would undermine any possibility of culture, since it implies a hierarchy based purely upon brute strength, cunning, regardlessness of value, and of consequence. He writes in another passage, "The modern failure of marriage that has so estranged the sexes from each other seems analogous to the social mobility," in quotes, "that has estranged us from our land, and the two are historically parallel." He doesn't make this connection, but he would see, I think, if he were aware of the article, a very close connection between Harvey Cox's Playboy doctrine of male. Women are seen just as sex objects, just as consumer items, and thrown away when they're no longer useful, and the way we treat land, that land is simply real estate. It's not something of inherent value to be nurtured and cherished and towards which one ought to be faithful. It is simply something for your own personal use and exploitation to be bought and sold and discarded. He says, in modern marriage, what was once a difference of work became a division of work. And in this division, the household was destroyed as a practical bond between husband and wife. It was no longer a condition, but only a place. A home became a place for the husband to go when he was not working or amusing himself. It was the place where the wife was held in servitude. And then continues with the provocative comment. He says, a sexual difference is not a wound, or it need not be. A sexual division is. And what, of course, he's referring to is that in the older household where both men and women had useful economic activity, where both were essential to the flourishing of the family, not just during the years perhaps when children were very small, but throughout the lifespan, you had sexual differences but not sexual division, and this made for a much more holistic, a more moral relation between men and women. He gives other examples. We're a little pressed for time, as does Gilligan. A nice case in Gilligan is towards the end of her book in A Different Voice, where they're talking about the issue of suicide. I'll just summarize it here because I wanted to leave 10 minutes or so for reactions from you on the lecture. It's fun on a controversial lecture of this type or a controversial subject to get some of your comments and reactions. But she refers towards the end of the book, this is around pages 136, 137, to a young woman named Jenny, who had been in a course in college on ethical matters, including the question of suicide, and the course apparently had taken the position that this is one's individual right, and if one chooses to commit suicide, that's quite okay, and so on. Let me read. She says, although the morality of suicide had been discussed in the course from the perspective of individual rights, this suicide, an uncle of hers had committed suicide and thrown everything into uproar, this suicide appeared instead to Jenny as an act of consummate irresponsibility, increasing the burden of care for others and adding further suffering and hurt. Trying to bring her feelings of rage into connection with her logic of reason, she reached an impasse in the discovery that her old way of thinking, that is what she had learned in the philosophy course and in the ethics course, did not work anymore. And here's a comment that Jenny makes. She says, the whole semester we had been discussing what's right and what's wrong, what's good and how much do you owe yourself and how much do you owe other people. And then my relative killed himself right then, and that's a moral crisis, right? And I didn't know how to handle it because I really ended up hating him. for having done that, and I knew I really couldn't do this, that is, according to the ethics course. I mean, that was wrong, but how could he do this to his family? And I really had to seriously reevaluate that whole course because it just didn't work anymore. All these nice little things that we had been discussing are fine when you talk about it. I remember we had little stories like if you were on a mission and were leading a patrol and somebody had to go and throw a hand grenade or something. Well, that's fine. But when it's something like this that's close to you, it just doesn't work anymore. And I had to seriously reevaluate everything I had said in that course and why, if I believed all that, I could end up with such an intense hatred. And she goes on, given the awesome, this is Gilligan again, given the awesome dimensions of this problem, the underlying logic of the equation of how much is owed to oneself versus others began to unravel and then fall apart. And here's Jenny again. All of a sudden, all the definitions and all the terminology just fell apart. It became the type of thing that you could not place any value on it to say, yes, it was moral, or no, it was not. It's one of those things that is just irrational and undefinable. And Gilligan says, Jenny realized that whatever the judgment, the action itself was irreversible, had consequences that affected the lives of others as well, and so on. Now, this is a splendid example because typically Mayo philosophers would have just discredited all those reactions as emotionalism and irrationalism and dismissed them. And Gilligan is not willing to do this. She says this is also part of the stuff of moral reality. And why do we think that all of this abstract, analytical, principled stuff should totally trump the feelings and experiences and tensions that we actually have when we're faced, in this case, for instance, with an uncle who commits suicide and leaves the family in the lurch? And she was wrestling with her feelings of anger and hatred for the uncle for doing this, which on the basis of the philosophy course were not permissible. It's a nice example. And in short, what I'm arguing is that there is no formula for how you bring these different ways of doing ethics together, but that part of the human condition is, as I've suggested in earlier lectures, we have to learn to live with a certain messiness. We tend to want to control everything, intellectually as well as technologically. And it's my judgment that in actually doing ethics, we can't control everything. That there are messy, intolerable, difficult, perplexing, puzzling moral realities that we just live through, and perhaps by God's grace or good luck, depending on your worldview or whatever, we muddle through and come to some resolution. And that's the world we live in, and that it's simply hugely discriminatory, and I think hugely depreciating of the female, if Gilligan and others are right about the empirical data, to act as if the one is totally rational and the other is just a lot of muddled irrationality, fuzzy feeling. That's the situation that I wanted to open up, and it's my judgment that today, more than ever, we need more, quote, female type of thinking about the environment, the land, animals, and so on, but that it has to then not just be women in the university thinking like males, it has to be truly liberated thinking. In the end, of course, I think we need both. I think we need each other, and the sooner we can move to that realization, the quicker I think we're going to be able to resolve some of these very difficult environmental issues that we face. I deliberately wanted to save 5 or 10 minutes for comments. We have the microphone, so please use them. And here's one, Jim, down in front here. And I like to use these especially so you can hear each other and so that we can get it on the tape. Right up close to your mouth so everyone can hear.
You've been talking about female thinking and male thinking, and I'm kind of wondering how much of it you think is innate, just, and how much of it is culturally constructed?
It's my judgment that And here I follow some of the people I think who've done the most in the field, the psychometricians and the geneticists. It would be my judgment that barring a truly disastrous upbringing, like Skinner's black box, you know, a child who's totally abused, my guess would be, and obviously this is not anything but a guess, that perhaps as much as three-quarters of it is genetic, innate, and a quarter of it environmental. Now, that quarter can be utterly dispositive or determinative, because if that goes wrong, then the person's a mess. If you abuse a child or totally refuse to educate the child, whether male or female, they're not going to do much of anything. That would be just a guess. You see, it's interesting here that most of us, I think, have always just took it for granted that there are significant differences between male and female that go beyond environment or education. One theory for these differences that we see is that they're all environmental. I think that theory has poor support, and that it has increasingly poor support as we get more more scientific data on the subject. That's just a guess. And again, mind you, I'm not talking about individuals. My daughter is more masculine in many ways than my son. They're both wonderful kids, and I would never want to change them. Okay, other comments or disagreements or questions or... Yes, Leah?
Okay, I'm not quite sure how I want to phrase this, and I know I don't agree with it, but I'm thinking that a feminist argument might be that these differences between male and female that you've been talking about have been the things that led to the discrimination and the problems, and that they're not true, and so we need to reject those differences in order to fix the problem. So how would you address that?
Well, the reason I have trouble with that is if those differences actually are there, if there are genetic factors and so on that are there, it's like saying, we don't like the way the moon looks, we'll pretend it's something else. If this is part of the reality that we face, then it would seem to me to be very, very foolish just to ignore that in the name of ideology. Now, but it's more than that, you see, because I think it's a much, much more interesting world. We have much better chances of really coming to some harmony with the environment and one another if there are these kinds of differences or these kinds of resources. Because many of the female-type resources may come from men, and vice versa. You know, this is not speaking against women as engineers or even astronauts or whatever, although it could raise questions about something, whether it's desirable, for instance, to have women in combat in the military. You might want to at least discuss that more closely. But I think it's a better world with this. So what troubles me, Leah, is that in so much of this discussion, and I think this is true particularly, for instance, in our program in Human Development and Family Studies, the material is presented so ideologically. They're just not an open presentation of data and arguments and ideas on the other side of the question. And so I think to a large extent, college students today are getting brainwashed. I think this course on many of these issues is one of the most open courses in the university, because I really do try to be fair to different sides of some of these issues, and also try to present ideas that some of you are likely not to have heard. But it's a tough issue, but I would say basically the problem with that is, yeah, you can hope and pretend all you want to, but if this is the reality of who we are, there's going to be a certain futility in doing that. Yes?
I want to know why it's necessary to ground these modes of thinking in male and female. Why can't, since there seems to be so much dispute over the different proofs as to what is inherent and innate, why can't we just say there's like different ways, or at least two dominant ways of looking at issues, and that maybe our culture is pretty bad at recognizing some of them, and instead of saying giving these convenient vehicles and saying, well, this is the more feminine way, this mm-hmm. is the more male way, because that leads to abuses, you know?
I think the main reason I would want to do that is because that's the way it is. In other words, if empirically this is just the way it is, that when you do the studies in as objective a way as you can and so on, more women come out here and more men here, why in the name of ideology should we deny that? And it seems to me that my assumption here is that in the long run, we're always better off with truth than with fantasy. So that even though the truth could be abused, and has been abused, obviously, it seems to me that we're better off with the truth on the issue. Now, and again, I would say that these observations have to be coupled with the other observation or assumption that to a large extent what we need today may be more nearly feminine type values than male or masculine. So that I think you could be more suspicious of this argument if I were saying that, still the masculine values are the real thing, but we ought to, in a kind of patronizing, condescending way, say, yeah, but women do it a different way. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that if we're really going to come to peace with nature and one another and so on, that it's my judgment that these relational, ecological, holistic ways of thinking are the most important today. Now, I could conceive of two or three centuries hence, maybe we would overreact and you'd have to say the opposite again. But what I'm really saying is we need both, and that if this empirically is the way we are, I would say let's accept that, but let's not accept it grudgingly. I think overall it makes a hugely more interesting life. Not just that there are differences gender-wise, but also that we then also make the commitment to look at each individual as an individual so that there's no problem at all. I didn't try to make my daughter more masculine because she reflected or more feminine because she reflected what seemed to me to be more masculine traits. I said, that's great, you know, Becky is doing fine, and same with my son. But that seems to me to be, in Iris Murdoch's term, an escape from fantasy and illusion. But it's a tough question. We really need a lot more time. As with so many of the issues we deal with in the course, it's very frustrating because that's a